From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and today we're going to focus on international relations and the American presidential campaign, particularly the situations in Ukraine and Russia and Israel and Gaza. Let's begin with a sampling of what former President Trump and Vice President Harris said about these areas in their speeches at the Republican and Democratic national conventions.
I will end every single international crisis that the current administration has created, including the horrible war with Russia and Ukraine, which would have never happened if I was president, and the war caused by the attack on Israel, which would have never happened if I was president. Iran was broke. Iran had no money. Now Iran has $250 billion. They made it all over the last 2.5 years. They were broke.
As Commander-in-Chief, I will ensure America always has the strongest, most lethal fighting force in the world.
Under President Bush, Russia invaded Georgia. Under President Obama, Russia took Crimea. Under the current administration, Russia is after all of Ukraine. Under President Trump, Russia took nothing.
I will not cozy up to tyrants and dictators like Kim Jong-un who are rooting for Trump. Who are rooting for Trump.
When we get back, I get along with him. He'd like to see me back, too. I think he misses me, if you want to know the truth.
Trump, on the other hand, threatened to abandon NATO. He encouraged Putin to invade our allies. Said Russia could, quote, do whatever the hell they want.
Our opponents inherited a world at peace and turned it into a planet of war. We're in a planet of war. Look at that attack on Israel. Look at what's happening with Ukraine. The cities are just bombed out. How can people live like that where buildings, massive buildings, are falling to the ground?
Massive buildings falling to the ground. Vice President Harris also had a long part of her speech focused on Israel and particularly Gaza and the Palestinian people. And we're going to come to that later. There was no mention of Gaza or Palestine or Palestinians in former President Trump's speech. But in recent weeks, we have seen Israel assassinating top leaders of Hamas, including one while he was in Iran. We also saw the first suicide bombing in Israel since 2016. Meanwhile, in Eastern Europe, Ukrainian military forces have made incursions into Russia with some success, but Russia has been targeting Ukrainian civilian energy infrastructure, power plants, and so on, which could lead to significant economic and civilian hardship, especially heading into winter. Joining us to talk about all of this, once again, is Nicholas Grossman, who is a political science professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's also writes at ARC Digital, sometimes with The Bulwark as well. He's the author of the book Drones and Terror, Asymmetric Warfare and the Threat to Global Security. Nick Grossman, welcome back to The 21st Show.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Brian. Good to be back.
So as you survey, let's begin in Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Russia. Ukraine has really taken the offensive in a way that surprised me. I don't know. What do you think about that? What have you been observing as you've been following the news out of there?
So when Ukraine invaded Kursk, when it crossed into Russia, it was a surprise to just about everybody in terms of war observers that the Ukrainians kept the operation fairly close to the chest, that they were both, you know, didn't want to tip off Russia, but didn't seem to, if they gave any heads up to other allied officials, they did so behind the scenes and quietly, and there weren't really leaks. But it seemed to be largely a surprise, and it has changed the dynamic of the war in a way that nothing really has over the past year, that this shook things up, where there has been a lot of fighting, a lot of destruction and killing, but without much movement on the line. And Russia seemed to be slowly grinding Ukraine down, using its superior manpower and resources to grind down Ukraine in the part of Eastern Ukraine And the Ukrainians were somewhat static with this and then did a surprise incursion, which has gone further than many expected, that where it looked like it could just be a quick raid and that they are now moving further in, taking more territory. Russia's been digging some defensive lines. It seems to have rattled Russia somewhat, at least surprised them. And we're not sure where it's going. It's going to be hard for Ukraine if they really want to hold that territory once Russia really tries to take it back, or at least press them, make it harder for them to hold it. But it did shake things up in a way that could either potentially set up future negotiations now that Ukraine has more to give away, or it could just prolong the war further.
What are the consequences that the Ukrainian people are experiencing from this, right? We've seen reporting that there's, you know, a lot of fatigue, war fatigue happening there. What sense do you have of where Ukraine is in terms of its ability to continue prosecuting its resistance to Russia?
So I think there are a few different aspects to that. One is terms of morale, that you know, Americans of all people can understand the idea of give me liberty or give me death, or, you know, no foreigner is going to come in here and invade and tell me what to do. I'm going to fight back, you know, fight for my freedom. So the morale on the Ukrainian side has always been higher and than on the Russian side, which is pretty typical in terms of, say, war of conquest. Or, you know, from, say, more recent, maybe American perspective, this is not all that different from the U.S. in Iraq or the U.S. in Afghanistan. That, sure, the U.S. cares, but not as much as the people there that are fighting for their home and, you know, that are willing to endure more as a result. However, with Russia just steadily grinding them down and nothing looking like a Ukrainian success for well over a year at this point, and last year's Ukrainian attempted counteroffensive was pretty disappointing in the results and was quite costly. And so their morale had been lower, and it looks like getting to get a hit in against Russia. This is the first time that Russia proper has been invaded since World War II. So getting that in seems to have been a boost to the Ukrainian morale, and, you know, see, we can get some shots in too, and they're not just going to grind us down forever. Either, you know, we can win, or at least we can force them to a negotiating table and force them to eventually back down and kind of give up the dream of conquest. It also potentially showed to the West, to the rest of the world, that Russia doesn't have an additional card to play. They're not holding back. They're not, you know, deliberately waiting and, oh no, if you really make me mad, then I'm going to escalate. That they have nuclear weapons in their back pocket.
So, yeah, escalation could mean a nuclear escalation potentially. We've heard that for years now. Yeah.
And that always needs to be, that's the backdrop of this. That's actually the backdrop of all geopolitics, all geopower politics since the, you know, 1950s. And that's, so that is unavoidable in that sense, but nukes are checked by nuclear deterrence, same as before, that it's the sort of thing where if, say, Ukraine was somehow, or even NATO, say, was marching on Moscow, well, then that's really an existential threat, and then there's a high risk of nuclear launch. But and losing a foreign adventure is not a existential risk in the same way, no matter how much Russia likes to say it. So the reaction from Russia has been quite muted. They did stuff that they're already doing. They lobbed a bunch of missiles and drones at Ukrainian cities. They've been doing that since, especially against civilian infrastructure and power infrastructure, since September 2022 was when they really started that campaign. And they keep doing it. So what do? They did more of the same. And it's ignited increased a debate in the West about restrictions that NATO countries, in particular the U.S., have put on Ukraine using some of the longer range missiles, where the U.S. says that they can't use those to strike targets inside Russia. And that's also a fear of escalation, fear of potential spiral, which is always prudent to care about, but looks like it was more prudent to worry about early in the war when capabilities were uncertain and intentions were not as certain. And with the Kursk incursion, looks decently less as a concern, because if Russia was going to do some big escalation, okay, now you've really crossed the red line. If they were going to do that, getting their own territory invaded and having to evacuate, it looks like over 100,000 Russians, and seeing a bunch of their soldiers captured, and seeing at least the world pay attention to this, Russian state media tries to keep it quiet. But all of that, if they were going to do something really big, this would probably be it. And so a lot of the West is now debating with, it looks like, especially the French and the British saying that the gloves should be taken off, and the Americans and the Germans saying that they're worried about escalation and still want to keep those restrictions about hitting things like, say, airfields inside Russia that are used to launch strikes against Ukraine.
Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are talking about geopolitics this morning with Nick Grossman, who is a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I should say, because Nick is teaching while we are on the air today, we taped our conversation earlier this morning. You can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. So, Nick, that's the sort of Ukrainian side, morale and materiel. Is that a factor in Russia as much? We've heard about unhappy conscripts, but obviously they have a big war machine there.
So it has to be a factor to some extent. Everybody has limits. Everybody breaks. Everybody always cannot go beyond a certain point. And there are signs that Russia is being strained in that the people that they've used, you mentioned conscripts, the people that they've used to try to stop or really slow down the Kursk incursion have been largely untrained or less trained conscripts. A lot of them seem quite young, don't have experience, maybe don't have much training. And that's one reason why the Ukrainians, who seem to be doing some of their, both better equipped, more experienced, more talented units, have been able to move forward a lot. And if Russia really were, say, just sitting on tons of resources that it could tap whenever it wanted, it would be sending way more forces into both eastern Ukraine and to stop Kursk and maybe attacking elsewhere also. So they are strained, but very much in the war effort that with some supply from North Korea and Iran that has helped Russia get things like the shells it needs, various mobilization and conscription efforts, not full out draft, but still a lot of recruitment and increasing the pay also for volunteers has gotten Russia the manpower it needs to keep prosecuting the war. But most military analysts looking at it think that Russia's capabilities to actually prosecute war in Ukraine probably peaked earlier this year and that they will be able to likely reconstitute it. They have Russia is more geared up for a long war. I think they've devoted now up to 8-9% of GDP about is being spent on defense. And so a lot of the economy is now a war economy, while the in the West of Ukraine's external suppliers is not. So the Europeans are spending a little more on defense. The American defense budget is basically the same and, you know, very large already. I don't want to give the impression that it's small, but not built around, you know, it's more in the range of 3% of GDP. And so not built around that same type of war economy. But this shows that Russia has cracks, but also there does not seem to be, as best I can tell from the outside, because they, you know, try to keep this pretty hidden, but there doesn't really seem to be a political challenge to Putin to the extent that maybe you could think of, I don't know, if Russian generals or soldiers or various Russian elites are fed up with the war, that can they do anything about it, get him out of power, make it stop? There's no sign of that. Probably the biggest sign of that was when the mercenary Yevgeny Prigozhin tried a basically a mutiny and was on the highway on the way to Moscow and then seemed to lose his nerve. And then, you know, later that Putin killed him and that when, you know, blew up his plane over Russia and the rest of other leaders of the Wagner group. And since then, there haven't really been signs that Putin himself is in trouble. But Putin, like anybody else, any other leader of a country, has limits, has, you know, concerns about his domestic power. You can think of it even as minimally as the more challenges he has or more unrest he would have at home, the more he would need to devote attention and resources to repressing that and to keeping his own domestic power. So ultimately, the dynamic still hasn't really changed, which is that Russia has limits. As long as they keep on trying to take over Ukraine, they keep on using resources, the material, war material, people, and economic resources. They keep on doing it. And as long as Ukraine stays in the fight, as which is, you know, large extent up to them, but as long as they want to and keep fighting and keep holding Russia at bay and keep surprising Russia with things like the Kursk incursion, eventually that reaches a point where Russia decides that they don't, it's not really worth it anymore. And we've seen this happen a bunch, that I think one of the biggest misconceptions about the war is the idea that some Westerners, some Americans talk about Russia almost as if it's a hurricane, like it's, you know, a force of nature you just sort of have to deal with and accommodate. And we've already seen Russia reduce its war aims many times, that Russia was aiming to take Kyiv, the capital, and take over the whole country, and they couldn't do that and they backed off. They were trying to take over the whole Black Sea coast and to make it where Ukraine couldn't ship anything. And the Ukrainians thwarted that, and then they backed off. And they declared a bunch of parts that they occupied annexed and part of Russia, and this is Russia proper, and we'll defend it as if it's, you know, Russia proper. And then Ukrainians took back some of that, and Russia just kind of let it go. And similar thing now we're seeing with the Kursk incursion, the red line of, you know, like, okay, yeah, maybe you can fight back against Russian troops in Ukraine, but you can't attack Russia. How dare you? That's a real red line for us. We'll cross it. If you cross it, there'll be all this disaster. And you know what? No, they're just doing more of the same, because that's what they have to do, and because they have limitations of resources. So it still remains ultimately both obviously a contest on the ground, but a contest of will, of who is willing to endure this awful suffering and death for longer, and try to make the other one see their will break. And that's actually one reason why I've thought for a while and still think that there's no chance that the Ukraine war could end before the U.S. presidential election, because the possibility of U.S. policy changing dramatically from being the current support of Ukraine, or perhaps even more support of Ukraine if Harris is elected, to switching to wanting to push Ukraine to surrender to Russia and to make a lot of concessions to Russia if Trump is elected, that would mean that both Ukrainians and Russians are watching to see what happens, because that would affect the war so much.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with Nicholas Grossman, assistant professor in political science at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. You can read his writing on ARC Digital, where he is a senior editor. He's also the author of the book Drones and Terror, Asymmetric Warfare and the Threat to Global Security. We're going to continue our conversation after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we are talking about international relations, foreign affairs, global affairs, however you want to say it. My guest for the first part of the show today is Nicholas Grossman, who is on the faculty at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, political scientist. He's also writes, senior editor at ARC Digital. You can also read his writing in The Bulwark and elsewhere. And he is the author of the book Drones and Terror, Asymmetric Warfare and the Threat to Global Security. We are talking specifically, before the break, we were talking a lot about Ukraine and Russia. I want to turn now to what has been happening in Israel and Gaza with Hamas and the Palestinian people. And this is something that I think has become much more salient for American audiences this year in terms of the campus protests we saw earlier this year. There was an effort to protest at the Democratic National Convention. In fact, you know, maybe we should begin with some tape, actually. At the first part of the show, I played some of the comments that former President Trump and Vice President Harris have made about Ukraine and Israel. I wanted to play both of their comments on the Palestinians. Unfortunately, Trump did not have any comments in his acceptance speech at the RNC, at least, to keep it parallel. So let's listen to what Vice President Harris had to say on this subject in her speech.
I will always stand up for Israel's right to defend itself, and I will always ensure Israel has the ability to defend itself, because the people of Israel must never again face the horror that a terrorist organization called Hamas caused on October 7, including unspeakable sexual violence and the massacre of young people at a music festival. At the same time, what has happened in Gaza over the past 10 months is devastating. So many innocent lives lost. Desperate, hungry people fleeing for safety over and over again. The scale of suffering is heartbreaking. President Biden and I are working to end this war such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination.
All right, Nick, what do you hear from Vice President Harris there that's maybe different from other American leaders?
So Harris seemed in her speech to be trying to strike a balance that to not take either Israel or Palestinian side outright, to express sympathy for both, to, you know, show that both have suffered quite a bit, that the U.S. being in a unique position in this, both as the global superpower, but also being deeply entwined with Israel since the founding, as an advocate of the founding of Israel, and having a special relationship. It's not a formal alliance, but, you know, one that is effectively an alliance and military cooperation and the rest. So to reiterate, it's both a speech at a convention is simultaneously, I heard it at least, as both a foreign policy speech of a future president, of one who will try to balance those concerns, will try to deal with. I appreciated hearing about the situation described as complex, that I think, at least for me personally, that where a lot of people want it to be simpler than it is, which I think is a very natural impulse, because the complexity of it and the suffering in it is so frustrating and so upsetting. But the U.S. position of trying to balance both of them without, say, disrupting that too much, of remaining in a partnership with Israel, and also caring about the Palestinians. So it did not seem on the potential future situation of a future plan to be substantially different than, say, U.S. two-state solution calls. That I think the first president, I have to double check on this, but I think the first U.S. president who made a very explicit call for Palestinian self-determination was George W. Bush. At very least, I can tell you that he definitely said it. And so it's not something that, you know, she phrased it differently, but that part's not brand new, although it does contrast pretty dramatically with her opponent. The other way, when I say appreciate the complexity of where one of the most difficult things for the U.S. in this is that the situation is not entirely local, meaning what is going on is not just Israel-Gaza or Israel-Hamas or Israel-Palestine, that a lot of it takes place in a broader regional context. And a lot of states, both in the region and I'd say national security establishments, U.S., Europe, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, UAE, all largely see it, or at least I say to a significant extent, as a regional competition where it's those countries kind of in a loose coalition, and Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis in Yemen, the Shia militias in Iraq and Syria that broadly call themselves the axis of resistance on the other side. And so when the U.S. president is approaching Israel, there are dual concerns, or maybe more than dual concerns. So there's, you can think of reasonable for Israel to protect itself, especially in response to an attack like October 7th. Reasonable for Palestinians and anybody, you know, who cares about them, I'd say any human being, to be upset about the level of violence that Israel has responded with, and including a lot of the indiscrimination of the attacks that has caused more Palestinian death than various other, you know, options, more innocent people being killed, a lot of them being kids. And also that doing something that would make Israel weaker and more vulnerable to Iran and Hezbollah would likely increase the chances of regional war and make the death and suffering so much larger than already the large scale on which it is, both by either the Israelis wanting to, or at least parts of the Israeli government wanting to invade Lebanon in response to Hezbollah, and Hezbollah and Iran both then potentially being more tempted to press their advantage and try to use force against Israel, and trying to, so the U.S. is trying to simultaneously deter regional war, keep the region from really blowing up, while also trying to get a ceasefire in the Gaza war, when both the negotiators of Israel and Hamas are still just in fundamental disagreement on what they wanted to work with. So you've got the U.S. working with Qatar and Egypt to try to broker that ceasefire. And then also on top of that, because Harris and Trump are both presidential candidates, they then also have to manage domestic constituencies. And how do they talk about this in ways that appeal to the largest number of potential voters? And so what Harris said bothered some of the most adamantly pro-Israel voices by being, you know, more sympathetic to the Palestinians than they would have liked. And it bothered some of the most strongly pro-Palestinian voices by things like describing the Israeli suffering more in active voice, as in these people killed by Hamas and sexual violence, and describing the violence in Gaza more as passive voice, as in people dying there, as opposed to and Israel killing people there, or bothered some of them by describing by saying showing support for Israeli security rather than by saying the United States is going to treat Israel like a pariah and cut off the relationship and cut off all arms. And then Israeli security, oh, if you don't like that, well, that's your problem, or something along those lines. And so she clearly did not appeal to people that are more stridently on one side of that or the other, but is, you know, in that way, both navigating the presidential election and attempting to navigate the complex foreign policy, while also as vice president in an administration that is conducting foreign policy now and trying to do negotiations. So I think it is, to some extent, a bit of an open question that we'll never get a good answer on, of will the Harris administration differ from the Biden administration on some of the specifics? And that's really hard to say because so there's so much current diplomacy, complex diplomacy going on now, that it's unlikely that her campaign, if they did want to go in a significantly different direction, would say so now, thereby undermining the potential for negotiations for a ceasefire. So it's possible that they would want to just simply continue the Biden administration policy. It's possible that they would tweak it a little. It's possible even that they would break with it more dramatically. But if that's the case, I think for domestic politics reasons, they wouldn't say, and also for the negotiations now, they wouldn't say so necessarily in advance, which also is not great as a voter if this is your primary voting issue. Although then again, Harris and Trump present such drastically different attitudes towards the conflict, towards Israel and Palestine more broadly, towards international relations more broadly, that it is still a pretty drastic choice, although maybe not an option that some, especially I'd say the most sympathetic towards the Palestinians, are finding an option that would be ideal or close to their ideal.
Yeah, and we certainly saw that with the protests at the DNC last week, although they certainly, strikes me, they fell short of what the organizers wanted. I don't know that it was really enough to pressure Harris and the Democratic Party writ large to sort of change the position that she enunciated from the stage, which, as you said, stop bombing children, free the hostages, seems to be where, to the extent Americans do think about this conflict, a lot of Americans are on this. Let me take a moment to remind people this is the 21st show. We are talking with Nicholas Grossman from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We taped this conversation earlier today because Nick has class as we are going to air, so we are not taking calls live for this, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. Does Netanyahu even want peace right now? I think that's an open question, right? There was some reporting, I think, that Trump was maybe even in communication with him, or certainly you could say he's signaling to him that they'll get a better deal from me.
So this was one from, I think it was the reporter, Judy Woodruff, I think, was the one who had first reported this, that she said Trump met with Netanyahu and told him, basically, don't make any sort of ceasefire deal because I'll give you a deal more to your liking. You know, don't do it. And I haven't seen that widely confirmed. I mean, also, it's, you know, about a private meeting. So who knows? That certainly strikes me as plausible. But we don't need to just speculate or say go on Trump's words. He was president already. We have a record that we can look at. And his record in office was to basically give Netanyahu just about anything he wanted. And a good example of this was moved the official U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which under international law is still disputed territory. No previous American president did that because they wanted to try to broker negotiations, said the status of Jerusalem will be a factor, will be something for negotiations. And Trump, and it's something that Netanyahu and his coalition have wanted for a long time, and Trump gave it to them in exchange for nothing. And there are a few other examples of that, of cut off funding to Palestinian hospitals in East Jerusalem, of there's a area in the Golan Heights, you can look this up online, of Netanyahu smiling as he inaugurates Trump Heights, of like a new, I don't know, like real estate venture or something that's up there. And so they have been, if not, say, always seeing eye to eye, decently more closely aligned. I think that both in this specific war and in a broader sense, that it is reasonable to conclude that Netanyahu does not want peace, or, you know, in the sense of unless it's totally on his terms, which when which things can almost never be. So that is, those are effectively the same thing. And that Netanyahu also has a long record. And we can see things like when Hamas being in charge of Gaza before October 7th, that the Netanyahu-led government kind of propped them up a bit. That would turn a blind eye to some of their smuggling, and that this was both a way to help manage the situation in Gaza, but also something that Netanyahu has openly bragged about how he helped, the way he put it is he helped prevent the emergence of a Palestinian state, and part of the way was by keeping the Palestinians divided between Hamas in Gaza and Fatah and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. And then being able to turn around to the world and argue, I don't have a partner for peace. Who could I negotiate with? They're so divided. And so he does not seem interested in it. He has a very strong both personal and political incentives where there is his polls are really bad. He had been facing criminal charges for things like financial conflicts of interest related to that, bribery, corruption, and could potentially go to jail, could lose power. His right-wing coalition, the farthest right-wing coalition in Israel's history, has a number of people who are outright supremacists, like meaning there's a, one of them is a party that it translates to Jewish power. And if you think, if you're an American and if you think white power, you're actually pretty darn close to what they mean by that. And so that coalition knows that if they lose this government, if there are new elections, that they're probably out of power, that this is kind of their one chance. And that if the war ends, and unless it ends in something that is very favorable to them, which, you know, is not currently available and probably never will be, that unless it ends that way, that they are in trouble. And by Israeli law, they don't have to have elections until 2026. So my guess is that they will try to hang on until that, much like we talked about with Russia and Ukraine, because Trump would, based on the record of his time in office, would likely take an attitude that is much closer to sure, Bibi, whatever you want, than the current U.S. attitude of both of all sides need to sacrifice something to get an agreement. As you know, the current attitude that if that's the case, then Netanyahu at minimum has incentive to wait, even if it they calculate that, say, Trump is, I don't know, a 30% chance. Like if Harris rises in the polls, that's still a pretty big gamble that would get them so much rewards. And there doesn't seem to be much downside to Netanyahu specifically and his governing coalition with the domestic politics in Israel to keep the war going. There are a lot of people that are mad at him for not getting, a lot of Israelis that are mad at him for not securing a hostage release. But largely those are either people who didn't vote for him, or people still who can't force him to call elections now and therefore ultimately have limited leverage over him. So no, I've not gotten the sense that they want peace. The Israeli negotiators have reportedly moved off some things. So I don't want to give the impression that they're treating, you know, all of the negotiations in bad faith. There have been a bunch of reports where the U.S. got them to concede something and then Hamas said that, you know, that they wouldn't agree to it or wouldn't concede. So Hamas is definitely playing a role as an additional role as blocking the success or preventing the success of ceasefire negotiations. But yeah, I think Bibi's playing a role in that, too.
Well, a bracing conversation, not a lot of reason for hope in the short term, at least, but we will continue to follow it. Nick Grossman, thank you for being with us to share your insight with us on the 21st show.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We are about to take another break, but before we do, I want to mention we are working on a segment about corporal punishment. Illinois recently enacted a law that bans corporal punishment in private schools. It had long been banned in public schools. Now it's also in private schools. We're also curious, though, about corporal punishment in the family setting. Is that something you experienced and you're willing to share your perspective on it? Or maybe as a parent, you think it's important. Maybe you think it's not a good idea. Let us know what you think about corporal punishment in parenting and in school as well. Email us, send a voicemail. All the ways to get in touch are on our website, 21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. More to come after a short break. Stay with us.